part of what leadership should attempt to do is to get people to think. If you're just asking questions that move people into a defensive posture or a lot of closed-ended questions, then all people are doing are responding. That means they're going into the area of their brain where information is stored, they're pulling it out and repeating it. If you want people to think, they have to start applying their knowledge to create wisdom. Because you see, the power is not in knowledge. The power is in the use of knowledge, because that's where wisdom comes from.
Welcome to Upon Arrival, a show that uncovers stories and strategies that make up all the moving parts of business events tourism with me, Adelaine Ng. You might be rolling your eyes these days when you hear talk about the Great Resignation. But the latest U.S. jobs report indicates the phenomenon of career change en masse is not going away anytime soon. Even in Australia, where I am, while the big quit hasn't been as big a slide compared to the U.S., there are plenty of job vacancies available, especially in the hospitality and tourism sector, which means if you're a company or bureau leader or entrepreneur building a team, you're probably still nervous about losing some of your best people if you haven't already lost them. So is it possible to improve our workplace culture to prevent the talent bleed, or is it too late? What's the secret to making your people stick with you when the trend is to leave? If these are questions that intrigue you, you're going to love this conversation with Dr. Troy Hall, a global award-winning expert in talent retention strategies and author of Culture Cohesion, who's been featured multiple times in the media. Dr. Hall shares some truly golden nuggets about the key soft skills leaders need to create this culture, as well as some tips you can implement straight away that cost no money but make a significant difference to how your team feels about your leadership. Here's that chat. Dr. Troy, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for allowing me to be here. It's great.
So happy to have someone at your mastery level to talk about this subject. I think talent retention has always been topical, but now even more so with all the news about the Great Resignation. But I actually do wonder if it's actually too late for many companies to talk about talent retention now. I mean, has the Great Resignation boat sailed?
So let me just clarify a couple of things. I have been referring to what's going on as the Great Recalibration. So when you think about the Great Resignation, what people think about is, well, people quit, they resigned. Well, they did, but they found another job. They didn't go home and lay on the couch. They didn't collect their unemployment or something of that nature. They actually said, I have to recalibrate my work. I want to recalibrate my preferences. I want to make sure that what I'm doing is important to me and I'm doing it in a way in which I want to do it. So that would be my first thing that I would say. The second thing is, it is never too late to think about retaining talent, because it is always a constant evolution within an organization. You never hire one person and they stay then for their entire lifetime. Many times there are life events or things that occur within an organization where individuals transfer out or transition out. And some of those were because they planned to do it that way. For instance, there are organizations that may hire students who, once they graduate, then they go on to some other line of business, and maybe that organization couldn't absorb them or take them in. But when it comes down to talent retention, we are always focusing on how do we create the right culture that allows individuals to stay within an organization because they choose to stay, not because they've been run off.
Yeah, excellent point. So when you're talking about the Great Recalibration, though, are you saying that people are just moving to different companies that maybe are giving them just a little bit more flexibility in terms of how they work? And then there's this other trend we're seeing, which is some people have gone out on their own and become entrepreneurs themselves and starting their own companies. So I'm just wondering how much of this is a real shift?
No, excellent question, because what we're dealing with, the primary workforce expectation today is referred to as the entrepreneurial spirit. People want to have their own autonomy. They want to be able to understand what their job is, what level of authority they have. Do they have a level of initiative that they can apply to complete the job? Do they have all the resources they need to do it? So that entrepreneurial spirit can occur when the individual says, look, I want to do my own thing, and they can do that. So that would also be part of recalibration, because although they have resigned from the job, they're recalibrating what they're doing. or within an organization, they chose to say, my preferences are flexible work hours. I want to be able to do a work in an organization that respects me as an individual and how I can better fit into the culture of the organization. So it really works for both. But it is the workforce expectation is what I refer to as the entrepreneurial spirit that is out there. And that's what's really guiding a lot of the choices and decisions today.
Which presents new challenges, especially if you're new at this. There are a lot of people I know who are just, you know, trying to start out and recalibrate, as you say. And they're in a position where they're finding like, okay, now it's come to a point where I can either be working in the business or on the business. And they're having to start to hire staff, whether it's virtual or, you know, physically in a physical space. So I guess the challenge is also for offices that are trying to do this for the first time. Could you provide some guidelines as to, because a lot of people who are new at this are going like, okay, now how do I do this well? Do you have any quick and dirty tips?
Well, they may be quick, but not so dirty. How about that?
Oh, that sounds cool.
All right. So when I think about organizations, one of the things that I also want to frame for individuals is the work around talent retention for me deals with culture. And it's what I refer to as the Cohesion Culture Wellness Program. And within cohesion culture, there are three strategic elements that need to be present. They're belonging, value, and shared mutual commitment. So regardless of what tactic you tend to employ, the strategy needs to be that the culture is right and that the leadership within the organization needs to be focused. So a good place to start is making sure that leadership is ready for what they're about to do. In that regard means that what we're seeing is a transition of leadership from the I walk around with authority, you do it because I say so, to a little softer side of leadership that is more encouraging and engaging for individuals. And that is something that I refer to as the transformational leader. So that transformational leader has four primary elements or pillars that they should be having in place. They should be encouraging and working with their employees to aspire them to a vision. Now, it's aspire, which means that they're moving them toward a vision, not just inspiring them to something, but they're aspiring them to a vision. They can work towards something. They should also teach the vision. So in addition to this aspiration toward a vision, they're teaching it. That's the first component of the transformational leader. The second pillar of that is that they are a good social architect. It means that they know how to get along with people. They have adopted what I refer to as the seven attributes of an effective leader. They are teachable, compassionate, they extend grace, they practice humility, seek the truth, they really work with pure intentions, making sure that the decisions they make don't harm self or others, and lastly, they make peace. The third element is trusting environment. And in trusting, they're looking for how individuals how the leaders will actually respond to individuals very consistently. And do they create a space where people feel safe? And within that area, we look for leaders to get away from cultural superiority and think more about cultural relativity. Cultural superiority is when the individual leader thinks that their culture or their way of doing it is the best and nobody else is going to change their mind. When you're culturally relative, it means you're exploring culture or exploring how individuals interact within the work environment or within social settings in a way to know how did things get to be the way they are? How did that ritual, that tradition, that custom, that language, that symbol, how was it a part of that culture? And that cultural relativity gives the leader much more opportunity to create that trusted environment because they're not prejudging individuals based on something that they have as their own bias. Now, understanding, and this is maybe more complicated than what we want to get into, we all have biases, whether they're disclosed or not. The challenge is to make sure that biases don't control us, that we are able to keep an open mind. That's why I start with teachable under the social architect pillar, because it's important for the leader to have an open mind to accept new information and be ready to learn and be a constant learner if possible. And then the fourth pillar is self-regard. And that is where the leader is looking at the emotional intelligence, managing their emotions, managing the emotions of others. This is a place where empathy lives. Individuals should be thinking of how do I put myself into the shoes of someone else that I'm working with or someone else who's a part of the team. How does that work? And in an empathy discussion, you are putting yourself into the spot where you're trying to say, I think I know what they might be saying, what they're thinking, what they're doing, and how they're feeling. And when you have that, then you're able to really practice that self-regard, that self-awareness, manage emotions. So very quickly, for those who are listening and taking notes, those four pillars for that transformational leader is to aspire and teach vision, be a good social architect, create a trusted environment, and practice self-regard or self-awareness.
That sounds fantastic. But you know what? I think there's going to be a problem. The kind of person that you just described is rare. There's not a lot of self-awareness. And if you talk to a lot of workers, they'll say there are a lot of narcissistic bosses. So I wonder whether there's another piece here, which is getting talent recruitment right in the first place. But quite often we're stuck with what we've got. And I'm just wondering about, you know, this cohesion culture that you talk about. How do you know that you do have cohesion culture? I mean, this is a topic that you've really studied in depth, because I imagine that workers, if you ask them, do you have a healthy workplace culture, they have a more accurate picture of what's happening, more so than employers would.
Yes. And so in the really the interesting thing is a couple things. Number one, most of the people who hire me already are somewhat getting it right. The people who really need me, they don't see that they need me, right? Because of that narcissistic sort of comment that you made before. So again, it's working with organizations in that regard. Here's the thing about cohesion. Cohesion is a causal phenomenon. It means that when cohesion is present, you get performance. When you get performance, you get the level of engagement of the employee that you're looking for. That is someone who is helpful, active, vested, and eager. When you have that, you now have that level of engagement, but it comes as a result of cohesion. So it isn't so much about leadership or about the organization trying to make people happy or to make them satisfied. It's can they get them to work cohesively together? And when they build those strategic elements together, then they can produce performance and engagement. So I think that it's important to understand that. Now, having a cohesion culture may not stop this recalibration, because the recalibration is the preference in which the employee brings into the workforce as an expectation. I expect flexible hours. I expect a boss who treats me right. I expect to be fairly compensated. I expect to have resources. All those things are expectations that people have. What I try to do is to help organizations avoid the runoff by being more proactive in what they're doing. Like, when I worked with organizations, I suggested as soon as we got into this conversation regarding this remote work, that organizations should decide positions that could be remote. It's not going to go away. Employees are going to continue to want to do it. Why? For 2 years, we've trained people that you can work remotely and it works. And so they do not see any reason for it not to happen, other than an individual leader may prescribe that everyone has to be under the same roof to have a good culture or to get the work done. And the reality is, we've got tons of evidence that isn't true. So we can't do much for an organization if you have a narcissistic boss or if you have someone where the leadership isn't working right. What the data tells us is that the number one reason that people leave an organization is because they have a disconnect with their supervisor. And today that's been drilled down further to say that there's a lack of inclusion within the team spirit within the group. So I do know that cohesion can address that particular item. But like anything that we've talked about, if the leader doesn't see that it's necessary, if the leader doesn't say, hey, I want to put this in place, I want to create this kind of environment, then you're right. It goes back to the comment you made before. You're stuck with whatever you have. So it is incumbent upon the leadership of the organization to figure out how to get it right. And that's what I did through the book, Cohesion Culture, Proven Principles to Retain Your Top Talent. Fortunate enough for that book to become a best-selling book, and individuals can look at it and see everything they need to know as a leader, how to build culture, and how to put it in place. So the book is a complete comprehensive guide from start to finish. And we start with leadership because, as you and I have already said, If the leadership isn't right, it doesn't matter what happens after that. It's going to be all messed up.
And I think you're right that the bosses who aren't using your type of service probably aren't aware that they even have a problem. So you've actually done some numbers on this. How big a problem is talent retention? I mean, what is the problem costing businesses?
Yeah, so that's really an excellent point. So globally, the interesting thing is for dysfunctional teams who do not operate cohesively together, we are spending $7 trillion globally on correcting teams somehow, some way. When you do have a cohesive team, here's the good news. You get an uplift of 50% of your creativity and productivity when you have a team operating cohesively. And because it's a causal phenomenon, it's not just correlational. It's just not going to happen by happenstance. If you've got people who belong, who have value, who have shared mutual commitment, then they will produce. And when they do, you get a 50% lift in the production that you had with that group before you introduced cohesion, or that cohesion phenomenon, into the organization. Here's another cost to organizations. It costs up to 50% of an annual salary every time you want to replace someone. So a $60,000 salary is a $30,000 expense to the bottom line. That's a hard number. So those individuals who are number crunchers who are listening to this, these are real numbers that are happening. And by the way, you can assess your culture. I do a cultural assessment program where I do a baseline for organizations. We then put the changes in place. We then redo an assessment a year later. You'll be able to see the uptick of what you have. Plus, you'll also be able to see it in those soft numbers that come with increased revenue, with a reduction of expenses as a result of your employment. Also, taking a look at your creativity and productivity levels and how those will increase efficiencies within the organization. All of those items will play a difference. I also suggest that you will see an uptick of individuals who are contributing in the community. That part of this, because when they believe that they belong, when they have that efficacy of feeling of belief, it really motivates individuals in such a way that it's sometimes hard to describe. It makes it sound like it's an inceptual concept of fluffy clouds. But the reality is that when you believe, you know what can happen. And there are tons of examples of that. We can look into sports and find when sports teams have believed beyond incredible odds what has happened. When people are faced with situations when they are going to survive and need to survive, they will believe in surmountable ways to create that survival and to do that. And it all comes out of our belief system. So it's hard to ignore something that is that strong within an individual and for organizations to simply pass it off as saying, well, that's just too fluffy. It is definitely the meats and potatoes of the organization, because you know as well as I do, culture eats strategy for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snacks on it somewhere in between.
Wow, that was a mic drop, I think. And I presume that that belief has to come from the top. I mean, that goes without saying.
Absolutely. And that's why I always focus on leadership first. And when I work with an organization, I make sure the CEO is completely on board with what we're doing. The CEO doesn't do the work, but are they on board? Because I know that that senior leadership team is driven by the CEO. And if the CEO sets the foundation, the leadership team should also be following with that. And then you'll get your support throughout the organization, and you'll be able to drill it all the way down from the senior most person to the individual contributor. And they will then have a very robust and exciting culture.
How would a CEO, I guess, more intentionally put some of the things that you've been talking about in place? When you talk about belief that needs to transfer to the rest of the organization, to the staff, because it's quite often the case that the leader is, you know, tucked away in an office somewhere, often involved with meeting after meeting. They're not often that visible in the workplace itself. So in order to inculcate that culture of belief, what's needed? I mean, what does it take?
Well, first of all, it takes the leader to be out of the office, and not somewhere else out of the office, but actually involved with the staff. So one of the things that I do through the Cohesion Culture Wellness Program is I work organizations from start to finish. So we first start with our cultural discovery. So what is the organization like? We then do an assessment. We do a plan development based on that assessment and that cultural discovery. We then do education, which is a part of the plan. And then we create sustainability activities so that the organization can not only put it in place, but can actually sustain it. So what I suggest to organizations that they do in the very beginning, and I bring the leadership together, and this is before we really do any programs, any assessment, they do a 2 to 3 week empirical observation. So social learning works like this. It works with observation, imitation, implementation. So what you are observing, you make some decisions. Do I want to imitate this or not? And then do I want to implement it? And if I do implement it, it becomes a habit, and then I'm replicating it over and over again. So I want to apply that social learning aspect for the leadership and get them to bring some information to a first meeting. So for about 2 to 3 weeks, they record whether they want to do it by manual or digital, these observations. Are they participating in greetings? And what are the greetings like in the organization? Are people talking to each other? What are they saying? How are they doing it? When you come in the morning, do you simply go in and beeline yourself for the refrigerator to drop in your lunch and then go to your cubicle? Or do you actually talk to people? Do you have some conversations? Do you enter the building on the phone, stay on the phone? When you pass people, maybe nod to them and maybe give them a casual introduction, or do you spend time? Now, I'll tell you why these greetings are so important. When I spent time with the leadership at Duke Manufacturing in Prague, the leadership said to me that greeting was the most important thing in all of their employee surveys. That when the senior leadership took time to talk to the employees felt more as though they were a part of what was going on. They didn't expect the leadership to remember every child's name, every pet's name, every anniversary, but what they appreciated was eye contact and the opportunity to have interaction, to see these senior leaders as real people, not as just names on a piece of paper or as some figure that they may have seen in a distance that they've seen through a glass office. They really like that touch and that feel. So greetings within the organization are very important. The next thing is you listen for laughter. Now, it's not the har, 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 slap your knee kind of laughter. It is, what is the flavor? What is the temperature? What is the stress level that people have within the organization? So you're looking for a little bit of lightheartedness that happens. You're trying to assess, is there stress within the organization? Are people scurrying about? Do they haphazardly do things? Are they running from one meeting to the next? Do they value their work ethic based on how busy they are in those conversations? Do they actually spend time by the water cooler, actually engaging in some simple, playful conversations? Because we know that play, there's a lot of studies, it's another whole podcast altogether, but there's a lot of studies that support that play in the workplace is important. So that laughter, that stress release, making sure you're not burning people out, how many hours are they working, all those things you're doing through that conversation of listening for laughter. And then the third element is affirmations. How are people being affirmed? There are two components required for affirmations. One is to recognize the individual for the job they're doing and to appreciate them for the person they are. If you don't include both, you're not affirming. So you want to listen for affirmations. Are people doing it? If you're simply saying, hey, attaboy, attagirl, good job, thank you for doing that, you might be appreciating the person, but you haven't recognized them for the contribution that they've made. Imagine the difference when you affirm someone and say, you did a super job on that. Thank you for completing that form. Because when you did, you allowed this other department to do their work. And that contributed to the success for the consumer and the product and service that we were delivering. Now, do you have to be that deliberate each time? No. But you do need to have those elements of recognition for the work that was done and the appreciation for the person to get the affirmation. And these observations are very important because what it does is it begins to level set the thinking of the leadership team. Sometimes we have an idea that we have a lot of work to do. And when I ask people to write things down on a sheet of paper, recorded digitally or manually, all of a sudden they didn't have so many things to do, but their mind thought they had so many things to do. So this is an opportunity to really get some observation about what's happening, make some documentation, and then we can bring that into our session and actually begin to work on that plan development, because now we've got some real data based on the assessment that we take, as well as their empirical observations within the organization.
That's fantastic. And the things that you were talking about in terms of encouraging that cohesion, they're not expensive things to do. In fact, you know, any company with a tiny budget can adopt any of the things that you've just suggested and take morale up to a whole new level and belief up to a whole new level.
Absolutely. So I'll just give you a couple of examples. Now, whether you have a remote or virtual, or whether you have in-person or hybrid, you can employ these activities. So one of them is what I call morning huddle. The morning huddle is exactly what it is. Imagine that you're huddling like you're playing rugby, like you're playing soccer, playing football, playing basketball, baseball. You have a little huddle. You get together. You have a little talk, and then you go out and do the job. So it's really about getting people in the right mindset for the tasks that are at hand. It's not a huddle to give out all the assignments for the day. That can be done some other time. This is a 3 to 7 minute opportunity to get everyone together. Now, I strongly recommend that they do it every day, that there's a work day. But the leader doesn't have to lead the huddle. There can be different leaders within the organization who can do the huddle. You can also do cross-departmental huddles. You can do huddles in your own department. You can do huddles whether people are on the phone, whether they're on the screen, whether they're in person. You just include everyone into the huddle conversation. Now, there are some organizations that say, you know, a daily huddle is too much for us. We're going to do it once or twice or three times a week. Great, fine. Just put a program in place for the huddle, because it's how you start to cement that feeling of belonging and you get people into the right mindset for the job and the task that is at hand. Maybe you choose to do huddles when you have a very stressful day, or when you know there will be a lot of activity, or there's something special happening. So maybe the organization would target it that way. But they need to put huddles into the program. The other thing, now this is, I definitely tell you, every day you need to do this. It's called a daily debrief. And the daily debrief can be done by individual. So the huddle, you bring everybody together. The debrief is individual. So before the individual leaves, they can send an email, they can send a text, they can stop by and make a physical comment, they can be on the screen, send an email, whatever it is, whatever they want. But they need to give an assessment of how did they feel the day went? How did it go? And the reason for this is supported by research that's done by these two individuals, Amy Bull and Kramer, who wrote The Power of Small Wins, which is a Harvard Business Review article, so people can go out and look at it. And part of what they talk about is this progress loop. And the progress loop says how the individual feels internally will dictate how that individual feels about their job and the contributions that they're making. But more importantly, how they feel at the end of the day is how they're going to start the next day. Now, there can always be anomalies. There can always be outliers. There's always extenuating circumstances that may interrupt it. But there are people who can separate their work life from their home life. So they might feel good about their work, go home and not things be so great, but come back to the work because the work is a retreat. It's a respite for them. So they come back to work and therefore they pick back up where they left off the day before. And this is such a great aspect for individuals to do within the culture of the organization, because it creates that sense of belonging, contributes to value, and allows people to share in these mutual commitments that they have for each other and mutual commitments to the work that needs to be done with the group. So those are just two of the examples that I give you that organizations can apply immediately and get started, and they'll see results immediately by doing it.
It is so interesting, this kind of lends to the idea of the perception of work. So when we talk about the great resignation or the great recalibration, it's, you know, seeing your work as the evil one. You know, you're trying to get away from that place. But, you know, we've always also had a group of people who saw their workplace as the escape place from home. But if you say, you know, you like your pay rate and you kind of, you like what you do, you just don't like the culture at your workplace. And the boss isn't any help. He's not the kind of CEO that has the mindset that you were talking about. Is it possible for staff to actually take this on and build that sort of culture in their workplace?
Well, only if we were believed in Mutiny on the Bounty. If we believe in the uprisal of individuals within an organization to make a change, like in Dolly Parton's 9 to 5, where they were able to capture the boss and do something fun with him and change his mind. But for the most part, the individual contributor has limited power in an organization to make the change in the organization from the top down. Now, they can contribute from when the top down gets it right. They obviously can contribute and they should contribute, but it's very difficult. Now, are there some suggestions of individual contributors and what they can do? Yes, but it is so varied based on their situation that I don't want to just casually, you know, provide some advice and someone take my advice and then it turns into a horrific situation for them. But what I believe is, I believe in critical conversations, and I believe that all conversations should become unresolved. So I think that what I really encourage people to do is to talk about it, not just simply put up with it. That for too often, what we've happened with the social injustice that we've been seeing around the world is because we've tolerated things for too long. We've said we're powerless about it. I think there are ways that we can go about it, but we should go about it in a structured way so that our voice will create, you know, a path for change, as opposed to our voice cementing people into where they're stuck.
Yeah, very good thinking. Dr. Troy, can I ask, how did cohesion culture become a passion topic for you?
Well, I did my dissertation. Well, first of all, my PhD is in global leadership and entrepreneurship. My dissertation is in group dynamics with an emphasis on cohesion. And I've spent over 40 years in organizations through leaders, over 25 years in C-suite, and really focus on what does it take to make an organization a best place to work? And really looking at leadership that's done through John Maxwell, Simon Sinek, Brené Brown, even the words of the South African cleric Desmond Tutu, and that work of individuals, Maya Angelou, and her work, you know, I mean, all of these individuals have, you know, a real passion for people. And so cohesion culture was a direct result out of having that passion for people and making sure that organizational leaders knew how to get it right. I didn't want to take it for granted that maybe they could figure it out on their own, because obviously they weren't. So let's put something in place that allows them to do it. And people often like to know what is the recipe. What is it? They may not follow it, but they like to know what the recipe is. And that's why when I wrote the book, The Cohesion Culture, I made sure that it contained all the information that they needed. But they still need someone else like me to help them figure some of those things out and how is the best way to apply it. So hopefully together between the book and me, that organization will be set up for great success in their delivery of culture.
And then what kinds of change did you see happening when you implemented the things that you're talking about? I mean, if you were a before and after ad, what would that look like?
Well, the before ad is you have individuals who might be able to complete tasks, but they didn't feel good about them. You might have individuals who will simply show up to work and punch in the clock and punch out. You'll see individuals who will fake it to make it. But when you do the cohesion culture, when you actually are spending time with the leadership focusing on others first and then self, then you have given the individual everything they need to be their best self and to allow that come forward. You've taken all the obstacles, you removed all the obstacles away. So I guess a before would be a frown and an after would be a smile. And you feel better about what you're doing. And it isn't that the leader is trying to buy you off or the leader is trying to just, you know, be nice. I mean, in a cohesion culture, you still have accountability. You still have conversations when people don't do their work. You still talk about it, but you do it in a way that actually respects others. So part of it is I guide leaders through something I call a cohesive communication worksheet, which gives them an opportunity to really allow the employee to have self-discovery. Because you see, part of what we attempt to do, part of what leadership should attempt to do is to get people to think. So if you want people to think on the job, you have to ask open-ended, non-leading questions. If you're just asking questions that move people into a defensive posture or a lot of closed-ended questions, then all people are doing are responding. That means they're going into their brain, to the area of their brain where information is stored, they're pulling it out and repeating it. They're responding. If you want people to think, they have to start applying their knowledge to create wisdom. Because you see, the power is not in knowledge. The power is in the use of knowledge because that's where wisdom comes from. Wisdom does not come from knowledge that someone has gained and set on the shelf. They have gained wisdom because they have taken the knowledge and information and actually applied it, whether they were successful or not. And that reminds me of a message that my mom told me many, many years ago when it came to my leadership. She said a couple of things. One is this. She said that my character would always be defined by the choices I make, not the circumstances I find myself in. And she said, for those choices that you make and for who you choose to be and how you want to be, it isn't the successes or failures that will shape your life. It's how you handle them. So I completely understand that getting the mindset right will dictate what happens next, because the actions that we take are correlate to how we think. That's why I build those 7 attributes of an effective leader. We build the pillars of leadership in. We give people some real tangible things that they can do because we want them to be able to make a difference today, right now. We don't want them to have to go through a 15-week course before they can finally wake up and say, I can do it. We want them to be able to take common sense things and actually start applying them today. And if leaders just did this one thing, if they thought of others first instead of self, if they focused on others first and then self, it would make a huge difference in the world. Because what I'm saying is that it's not that the leader doesn't take care of his or herself. It's just that it's not the focus. That narcissistic person that you described earlier in our conversation is a person who focuses on me. It's on them. They want individuals within the organization to change for their preferences, their ways of wanting to do it, for how they see it to be done. Now, am I suggesting that the leader shouldn't lead and actually say, here's a course of action we should take? No, but that is a different conversation than how you treat people. So in treating people, you need to be thinking about how you respond to others first and then self. And when you get that right, you are going to see a magnanimous change within the organization. People will wonder where the old person went whenever this new person shows up.
Wow. Dr. Choi, many offices now have staff from different cultures, different ethnicities. I'm in Australia, which is a hugely multicultural country. Does cohesion culture need to look different where you do have different cultures involved?
Excellent question. So here's what I will tell you. Belonging, value, and shared mutual commitment exist in all cultures. How it happens will be up to customs, rituals, traditions, symbols, language. And so you consider all of those aspects to create how you will interact. But here's the thing. People want to be heard. They want to be respected. Doesn't matter where you're from. Listen to what people say. Now, if you are predominantly doing an organization that is rooted in Western culture, then the likelihood is that organization will take on a Western culture. I think it is unrealistic for an individual from another cultural experience to come into that organization and expect it to be exactly like the culture where they left. But what I believe is important is that that Western culture should not alienate other individuals. They should reach out. They should help figure out how can we make this work? What are the aspects of the culture of the individual and the culture that's present, and how do they create similarities and differences? One of the things that I recommend to organizations, and this is a technique from another company, so I'm not creating it as my own idea, but I'm going to reshare it, repackage it, and reshare it. I'm recalibrating it. It's called micro-learning, and it's teaching diversity, equity, and inclusion from a micro-learning perspective. Bring up conversations. Talk about things that others have not ever spoken about before. If you have individuals who have different ethnic backgrounds, ask what do they experience. Just simple little things to say, how do you experience this? What is it like for you? How should I respond to you? I don't want to be ignorant. I don't want to say the wrong thing. What should I say? Ask people. They will be willing to tell you how to respond. And be sensitive and aware of where individuals are. And make sure that, you know, no one should ever be the butt of a joke. No one should ever be the symbol of generalization to the point where that individual does not feel that they are included. So in the belonging aspect, we also add in inclusion, because it's not just enough for you to be invited to the dance. It's whether someone has asked you to dance. And that's where inclusion lives. Everybody can be invited to the dance, but if no one invites you to up to the dance floor to actually be a part of it, then you don't feel so much the inclusion. And you might fake the belonging, but you don't actually feel it. So the belief system isn't engaged because you have some resistance to it. You're not fully giving it everything possible. So it's a lot of complication. There's a lot of social aspects and psychological aspects that are involved. Even though my degree is in philosophy, I had to understand some of those areas to understand organizational behavior and how people interact in the social aspect, because a lot of those actions they bring to their work, they are pretty much the same.
That is so important, though, faking the belonging, because I've seen that so many times. And colleagues have rocked up to work, you know, they're all smiles. They're actually pretty happy, but, you know, at a deeper level, they have things that they don't really share with a lot of people. They end up putting up with a lot of things that are actually offensive to them or to their culture, just because they don't really want to cause much trouble. And it's part of their culture to conform and to not cause so much trouble. So just asking those questions, giving priority and room for that kind of conversation to happen, I think is so important and so appreciated. And I think just works towards the talent retention equation as well, so powerfully. So thank you so much for making that point. You have some team building elements in the program. One of the things the business event space gets excited about is team building. So how does that activity work, and what kinds of results have you seen for doing team building in workplace cohesion?
So the one thing I want to do is make sure that everyone is thinking of team building in the same way. So we're going to just make sure that we focus it. So people get confused about team building and team bonding. They're two different functions, two different words. We might use them synonymously, but they're not. Team building is building skills. Team bonding is building relationship. In team building, you can build relationships, but you are focused on the skill. In team bonding, you're only focused on the relationships. It is why when organizations say, let's have a pizza party, let's take people bowling, let's have ping pong beer Friday, here's what happens is that they've only created the relational aspect, and that's not enough sometimes, because individuals need to have the skills to help them with areas of communication, collaboration, conflict resolution, with creative thinking. So you create activities that are around it. So the work I do is with a gentleman named Benjamin Toy. And he is world renowned for his team bonding and team building activities. And so we have created a strategic alliance that brings the Cohesion Culture Wellness Program to life. And in those team building activities, we consider things like the four C's that I just described, which would be communication, collaboration, critical thinking, and conflict resolution. We talk about the four pillars of leadership, which is your aspire and teach vision, to be a good social architect, to have a trusted environment, and to have self-regard. So we have activities that go all around those things, and people then are involved in these lightweight activities. And then the debriefing that comes, the series of questions, and how does this apply to what you might be doing at work? And what do you see happening here? What was the interaction like? And it really makes a difference when people are engaged in an activity and they learn the concept through the activity, then all their senses are involved, or many of their senses are involved. And we know from learning that the greatest aspect is when all of your senses can be involved, but especially when you have your auditory, when you have your visual and your tactile, which is your touch, when those are involved, then people learn and they retain on a much greater scale. So we create programs that work with the executive leadership, which is the four C's, the four pillars, which we have is for the next level of management. And then for the individual contributors, we have a program called Core ID. Now, the good news is if an organization really does this right, then the senior leadership will go through the four C's. They will come and be a part of the four pillars. and they will be, and they'll bring that other group with them and be a part of the core ID. It's just the focus of the activities will be based on who the primary individuals are who are going to benefit from it. But there is such great information that comes from the leader watching the team do these activities and interact with people. You talked before about them being stuck in an office or going out to develop business and pay no attention to what's happening. You don't need a lot of time to walk around. Do some of these programs that we offer through the Cohesion Culture Wellness Program. Let that be a part of what you see, and you will discover things that you never saw before. We've done this program for Mercedes. We've done it for Bosch. We've done a small program for Salesforce. We've done work with regional food companies, with event companies. We've done it with insurance organizations, marketing groups. And all in all, whatever skepticism was there is quickly removed, because how you remove skepticism from a person is you give them proof. And when people visually see what's happening, they then can recognize the proof.
Excellent point. Can people work with you remotely? I mean, we're in an age where we kind of have to be ready for anything, right? So is it as effective to do this remotely, to be able to instill this cohesion culture in a particular workplace that is nowhere near where you can get to?
Yes. As a matter of fact, there is a company in Texas that is completely virtual. Every employee is virtual. There's nobody into a real life facility. I think they have a headquarters facility possibly for some pieces of business, but for the most part, everyone is working remote. Does it take more time? Yes. Why? Because when we can connect under the same roof, all of our senses are now working in tandem. But when we're right here on the screen back and forth, we only can rely on our auditory and our visual senses. We're missing some body clues. We can't see the full body all the time, so we only see people from the chest up. We don't get to see whether their arms are crossed, their legs are crossed. We miss those things sometimes because we can't see the whole screen. But in a room, we don't have those barriers of the screen and different backgrounds distracting us. It's easier. So is it easier when we're together? Absolutely. But can it be done virtually? Yes. And we've done sessions for organizations virtually and helped them adopt and create the activities that were right for them. And the important thing to know is this. I want to do something with you, if you don't mind. I want to do a little question and answer. May I ask you a few questions?
Yeah, sure. I'm nervous now, but yeah.
So what I want to demonstrate for your listeners is that although we talk about a cohesion culture having belonging, value, and shared mutual commitment, I want you to understand that the culture is not the same. So I'm going to ask you, do you like chocolate cake?
Yes, dark chocolate especially.
Have you had more than one piece of chocolate cake?
It's been a while, but of course.
All right. Now, you notice I didn't ask you if you had both of them at the same sitting, so we'll save that question for another time. When you tasted your chocolate cake, did your chocolate cake come from different bakers?
Yes.
Did the chocolate cakes taste exactly the same coming from different bakers?
Sometimes.
Sometimes. So there was a familiarity, but I suggest they were not exactly the same. And the reason is because of the primary ingredient of cocoa, it is milk, flour, and eggs a part of making the cake. Those ingredients are going to be different. And there are different choices that can be made: organic, non-organic, egg whites, goat milk, almond milk. I mean, there's a variety of things that can be put in. So I talk about the strategic framework for the organization to know that you lay belonging, value, and shared mutual commitment over top to create your chocolate cake, but it's going to taste different based on the way you mix it, based on those traditions, rituals, customs, language, symbols. So not every chocolate cake will be the same, but it'll be familiar. So that's what I say about a cohesion culture. Not every culture will be a cohesion culture. It will be your culture of joy, your culture of innovation, your culture of service, your culture of whatever it is that you have said that it is. It will still be that. But if we can get people to operate cohesively within the culture, then you overlaid that cohesion culture over top of your culture. Now your culture is performing in a way in which you did not have access to before, because it is a causal phenomenon, not correlational. I've got another series of questions for you. Are you up for another series of questions?
Yeah, shoot.
All right. Have you experienced a rainy day?
Of course.
Have you opened an umbrella on every rainy day?
Not always.
Have you been to the beach?
Yes, I have.
Have you seen umbrellas open on the beach?
I believe I have.
And when those umbrellas are open, has it rained?
No.
Great. So correlational data is making a statistical relationship between objects or items. I can correlate that there will be a strong propensity for people with rainy days to open umbrellas. I can even forecast that more umbrellas might be sold at the cash register of a retail store if you put umbrellas there, because individuals may run out, not realize that it's raining. They'll buy it because they need it. But opening umbrellas do not cause rainy days. Rainy days do not cause umbrellas to be open. But cohesion is a causal phenomenon. It's a cause and effect. If you have belonging, value, and shared mutual commitment present, you get performance and you get the level of engagement that you want from employees without having to worry about making people happy and satisfied. You want that to be a part of it, but that's not your focus. Your focus is not on engaging people by being happy and satisfied. You engage people to be helpful, active, vested, and eager by ensuring that cohesion is in place. And that's why I refer to it as the cohesion phenomenon. That's why cohesion is causal, not correlational. And that is why, even though I speak strongly about those elements of a cohesion culture, it does not dissipate your ability to have a culture of joy, of innovation, of service, of whatever you have created.
So everything really should fire on all cylinders when you put this cohesion culture right in place. Is it worth it for companies to, you know, a couple of bigger companies have installed what is the equivalent of a workplace happiness executive to look after all this stuff? In a way, it sounds like the big boss is kind of farming this out. It's like they don't have the time to do this. So like, let me just, you know, hire a full-time position out for somebody else to take care of this. And hopefully that sends a message to the rest of the organization that this is a priority. I mean, what do you make of that?
So that is really an interesting point, and I really appreciate you giving me an opportunity to speak to this. So here's what I say about the chief executive officer. They are responsible for everything that happens in the organization, but they don't do everything. Imagine if they didn't hire a chief financial officer. What if they didn't hire a chief HR officer? What if they didn't have a person in charge of operations? What if they didn't hire someone to be in charge of cybersecurity? So because the CEO has hired someone to be the chief experience officer or the chief culture officer, doesn't mean the CEO doesn't want to do it. It means that the CEO recognizes that this individual will be more acutely aligned with what needs to happen in the organization and should be that trusted counsel, that trusted voice that helps the CEO make good choices and decisions, much like the way the CFO helps the CEO make good decisions about the balance sheet.
So round of applause for companies that have done that. I've seen that, especially with mental health issues taking a little bit more prevalent in over the last year with everything that's been going on during the pandemic. Dr. Troy, I know you have a great book that we've talked about here, Cohesion Culture, and we'll put a link to your books in the show notes. But what are your go-to books or resources when it comes to thinking differently about workplace culture?
Well, I've read Dare to Lead by Brené Brown, so I like that particular book specifically. There is a book called The Go-Giver and The Go-Giver Leader. So those have been books of mine that I've looked to. There was a book called Differentiate or Die that I've read. There's another one, Dr. Tim Elmore did one called, it's the Generation IY, which is that millennial generation, and it's about their use and the adoption of technology. In the area, I've read Angela's book on grit. What I think is that you should explore leadership in a way that you don't have to think of yourself in this regard. I'm going to give people a break. You don't have to read every word of a book to say you've read the book. Can you give takeaways from it? Have you given it some credence? And what is that information you've taken and how will you apply that information? So it's not just about reading books so that I can do a check box like I would have maybe if I were in middle school, but it is taking the information and applying it and making sure, especially from leadership books, and what can you get from it? Hopefully that'll give some of the listeners some variety of things that they might look to.
Thank you very much. I know there is another book that's pretty close to your heart. That's Fanny Rules. You've written two books. They're quite different. But what's the connection between the two books?
Well, a couple things. So Fanny Rules is a book about my mom's leadership. And so to tell the quick story, when I was 12 years old, my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer. 50-some years ago, when you were diagnosed with cancer, the likely prognosis was death. But mom chose life. And so she said, I'll do whatever I need to do. I will take care of that. I will live every day until I'm no longer around. And so mom delayed surgery until the summer so that I could take care of her during that time. So I was by her bedside. She poured a lot of wisdom into me, a lot of ideas. Two of the quotes that I gave you earlier in the session were sessions that came from this time I spent with mom. Well, the good news is mom lived 43 years beyond that awful summer. But later in life, she contracted dementia and Alzheimer's. So the book, Fanny Rules, is 31 teachable moments wrapped around 9 rules for effective leadership. I told you before that if the leader isn't right, that it doesn't matter what happens. The connection is that Fanny Rules is a great way to augment the leadership that was in the first two chapters of the Cohesion Culture. And this book is set up to be a mentoring book. You can use it if you are the mentor or the mentee. You can use the book at the end of each chapter. There's a recap of the teachable moments and a series of questions that you can ask yourself for self-reflection, or you can be held accountable to those through an individual who serves as a mentor. And there's also a special link within the book when you buy it. And at the end of each chapter, there's a link that takes you to an online journal so that you can journal 31 days of your experience through Fanny Rules.
Wow. And Fanny was the name of your mother?
Yes. Fanny was my mother's nickname. So I explain how she gets her nickname in the book. And I know for different cultures, Fanny has a different meaning and it means something different.
Yes.
You know, what can I say? The girls that she hung out with, that's how she got it. And so it's all there in the book. And the important thing about the book, and I love talking about Fanny Rules even more than Cohesion Culture, but we really wanted to make sure that this podcast was really dedicated to the leadership activities for organizations. But, you know, mom's leadership, she was 98 pounds soaking wet. You know, she was a force to be reckoned with. We lived in a small, poor town in West Virginia with very limited, you know, means for financial success, not very much in the way of education. I was bused 45 to 50 minutes to the nearest school. We were 30 to 45 minutes from any kind of medical facility. This woman had a gift. And so she used that gift to make sure that I knew what leadership would be about and I could get leadership right. And so I love talking about the book, and my proceeds of the book benefit the Alzheimer's Association, and it's available on Amazon. You can download it for Kindle, paperback, or Audible.
She sounds like quite a character and quite an amazing woman, obviously has left her mark on your life. So she may not be with us, and I know you must miss her, but she lives on really through you. We'll put links to the books that you've talked about and to your books as well. How can people connect with you if they wanted to?
Well, an easy way to do it is to search me out through social media at Dr. Troy Hall. So that's Dr. Troy Hall, Dr. Troy Hall. You can go to the website at drtroyhall.com. And if you would like, I also am extending a free book offer to individuals. If you go to cohesionbook.com, then you'll have an opportunity. You can take advantage of it. And that's another way for people to connect with me. And hopefully they'll want to seek out some more of this information and want to engage in some great conversations about culture, because I'm up to it.
You've been fabulous. Thank you so much, Dr. Troy. I think there is so much more to dig into. And yeah, I would just encourage anyone who, you know, if this sparks something for you to get in touch with Dr. Troy. Thank you. I really appreciate your time. I've learned a lot.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And hey, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the chat, I would love a rating and review for this show on the podcast player you're using. And click the follow button if you'd like to be notified when a new episode drops. By the way, if you ever wanted to start a podcast, I have links in the show notes to some of my favorite tools, including Amazon gift cards and discounts. And if you need a hand to find out how to use these tools, reach out and say hello at uponarrivalpodcast@gmail.com. I'll be back soon to uncover more stories and strategies for a successful future. Till then, cheers.